Amitra David was a wonderful poet, translator, and teacher. Most of all, she was a lovely human being. The first time I heard Amitra read, she gave me a copy of a poem that I liked very much. That's the kind of person she was.
His name was Mickey, but I called him Blondie, and he was my dark angel. Actually, almost albino, with a poof of cascading tresses blindingly blonder than Monroe's, a rough-hewn horse-like mug, and a fashion sense which was a breathtaking collage of Coco Chanel, Janis Joplin, and Ma Kettle.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. There's newly found marriage equality in Newfoundland, an award-winning lesbian poet is remembered, and a pre-Castro queer recalls a sister amidst the sex and mayhem. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the 3 weeks ending January 8, 2005. Newfoundland has become the 8th region in Canada to extend equal marriage rights to same-gender couples, with a provincial Supreme Court decision in late December. The case was brought by two lesbian couples who had been denied marriage licenses, Jacqueline Puddle and Noel French, and Lisa Ziegler and Teresa Walsh. Neither the federal nor provincial governments opposed their lawsuit. The court followed others in finding it violates the Federal Charter of Rights and Freedoms to deny marriage to gays and lesbians. Puddle and French were the first to be married in a ceremony presided over by St. John's Mayor Andy Wells 2 days after the ruling. The court's decision also opens marriage to gays and lesbians in Labrador. The Canadian government is expected to introduce federal marriage equality legislation later this month.
But the landmark late November South African Supreme Court of Appeal decision in support of marriage equality is being appealed by the government. The Department of Home Affairs is asking South Africa's Constitutional Court to weigh in on the issue. A spokesperson said the department is keenly aware that the national constitution prohibits sexual orientation discrimination and has no wish to deny equality to gays and lesbians. But he said the department felt any change in the marriage law should undergo the full process in the courts, plus investigation, reporting, and discussion by the Cabinet and Parliament. The South African Law Reform Commission is expected to report to the Cabinet this quarter. The Commission had first opened for public comment its formal proposals for both marriage and civil unions in 2003.
The South African Christian Leadership Assembly, a new coalition of religious groups including some of the nation's largest churches, last month protested the Supreme Court of Appeal ruling. The group called for a national referendum on marriage equality, declaring the courts had gone against public opinion and should not be left to make the decision alone. While insisting they believe in love and acceptance of homosexuals, they said that, as a society, we cannot afford to adopt laws that are also in conflict with God's laws, as encapsulated in the Bible and in the writings of all major religions.
Spain is a step closer to marriage equality with the Cabinet's approval of a bill at the end of December. The government's measure is expected to be introduced in the Parliament in February. Despite vigorous opposition from the Roman Catholic Church, passage is expected to make Spain the third nation to open marriage to same-gender couples, following the Netherlands and Belgium.
But Slovenia has been struggling for 8 years over legal recognition for same-gender couples and is no closer to a resolution. In an unusual move in late December, the government withdrew a domestic partnerships bill that had already gone through its first round of parliamentary debate and announced it is drafting a new bill. Two left-wing opposition parties, the Liberal Democracy of Slovenia and the United List of Social Democrats, this week reintroduced essentially the same bill the government had withdrawn, calling it appropriate and comparable to the laws adopted by other EU member states. In July, the bill had firm support from the ruling coalition parties, Democratic Party of Pensioners of Slovenia and the Slovene People's Party.
Austria's biggest opposition party has taken a pioneering formal stand in support of both immediate legislative action to create legal registered partnerships and ongoing work toward marriage equality for same-gender couples. The Austrian Social Democratic Party agreed to these positions at its biennial federal party convention in late December. The Austrian lesbian-gay civil rights group Reichskomitee Lambda, known as RKL, cheered the Social Democrats for joining their movement to open marriage to gays and lesbians, but noted that other parties will have to follow suit for any bill to pass.
Israel has no mechanism to formalize same-gender relationships, but courts there continue to expand their legal recognition. In late December, the Tel Aviv District Court barred the deportation of a Colombian gay whose passport had expired based on his relationship with an Israeli man. The Colombian had applied for permanent residency, but the Interior Ministry wanted to deport him until his residency has been decided. Although Israel's High Court had previously rejected deportation of foreigners married to Israeli citizens, the current ruling extends that protection to common law couples, regardless of gender. The case for the Colombian was brought by the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, and the ruling is expected to change Interior Ministry policies.
The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, has also won some court decisions favorable to gay and lesbian families in three U.S. states that adopted constitutional amendments against same-gender marriage in November. Montana's state Supreme Court split 4-3, but decided in late December that it violates the state constitution for the state university system to deny gay and lesbian couples the employee spousal health care benefits it offers to unmarried heterosexual couples. That state high court ruling overturned a 2002 ruling by a lower court. The majority of the justices said their decision was not about the ability to marry, but about equal treatment. The ACLU, which brought the case on behalf of two lesbian couples and the group Pride Incorporated, hailed the ruling as the first U.S. state Supreme Court decision to find that a state is constitutionally bound to extend domestic partner benefits to gay and lesbian couples.
The ACLU won a unanimous ruling from the Georgia Court of Appeals in mid-December that allowed a lesbian mother to regain custody of her two children. There were a number of complications in the case of Amber Crosby, whose son and daughter were given to his father and her grandparents, respectively, following an anonymous tip. But the appeals court agreed that the juvenile court had incorrectly used Crosby's lesbian sexual orientation per se as the determining factor in ruling against her and struck down the juvenile court's order denying her custody.
The ACLU also acted on behalf of a gay man and a lesbian to challenge Arkansas's unique ban on foster placements in any household, including a gay or lesbian. The ACLU won the first round in late December. A trial court judge did not use the ACLU's argument for equal protection, but declared that the state's child welfare agency had exceeded its authority in an effort to regulate public morality. He found that the 1999 blanket policy against gay and lesbian fostering had no rational relationship to the agency's mandate to promote the welfare of children. The state is already acting to appeal the decision. Arkansas does allow permanent adoptions by gays and lesbians.
Florida's notorious ban on adoptions by gays and lesbians has been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, but some homophobes there are apparently taking the law into their own hands. The Orlando office of the group that organizes Gay Days at Disney World was vandalized twice in December, the second attack last week including 9 or 10 bullets fired through its storefront window, as well as paintballs and eggs.
And New Zealand is wondering if its current controversy over civil unions legislation may have motivated an arson attack on an Auckland gay club in late December. Apparently, a firebomb was detonated at the entrance, sending flames and glass into the street, and smoke and flames up the main stairwell. Although there was significant property damage at Flesh, possibly $100,000 New Zealand dollars worth, 20-odd patrons, staff, and residents were able to escape without harm through an emergency exit.
Incitement to hatred or violence based on sexual orientation or gender is now a crime in France, punishable by fines of up to 45,000 euros and up to a year's incarceration. In late December, the French Senate passed the government's bill that the National Assembly had approved earlier in the month.
And finally, the late December tsunami in the Indian Ocean that devastated South Asian coastal areas may have disproportionately affected gays, since the tourist areas tend to be the most gay-friendly. Thailand's gay capital, Phuket, was hit hard, with more than 5,000 dead and nearly 4,000 missing, though the operators of the gay resort Connect encourage others to go ahead with plans to visit there.
The Sri Lanka lesbi-gay group Companions on a Journey reported that 36 of its members died, 9 are missing, and about 130 have been left homeless, though the rest are working hard to help them out. The group also reported that some homeless members have experienced homophobic harassment in the temporary camps set up by local governments. Another lesbi-gay group, Equal Ground, reported that a number of Sri Lanka's gay venues were completely wiped out. One of the better-known gay tourists who managed to survive in Sri Lanka was U.S. interior designer Nate Berkus, a regular guest on The Oprah Winfrey Show. He was able to hang onto a telephone pole while the waves passed, though his partner, photographer Fernando Bengochea, was swept away.
The Indonesian areas closest to the epicenter of the undersea earthquake that triggered the tsunami had no regular contact with national lesbi-gay organizations, which at last report have not been able to obtain information. However, the group Gaya Nusantara reported that Medan, the major city on Sumatra's east coast, which has a sizable gay population, was unaffected. Many lesbi-gay groups and venues around the world have been raising funds to support relief efforts. One way to contribute is via the website of ILGA, the International Lesbian and Gay Association, at www.ilga.org/donate.asp. You should indicate Asia in the comments box.
That's News Wrap for the 3 weeks ending January 8, 2005. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
A hippie-era homo has a buddy story that probably won't ever become a TV movie, but you'll hear the mind-bending story right here later in the program. In the year 2000, Almitra David was proclaimed one of 10 poets to watch, but 3 short years later, she was gone. Fortunately for us, This Way Out commentator Janet Mason had the opportunity not only to watch, but to become personally acquainted with the acclaimed lesbian writer, teacher, and translator.
Almitra David was a wonderful poet, translator, and teacher. Most of all, she was a lovely human being. The first time I heard Almitra read, she gave me a copy of a poem that I liked very much. It was called Fig and was about Pittsburgh, where she had grown up, where, as she wrote in her poem, women still cut crosses in their bread, still roll pasta to dry on the table, still wait for the orange zucchini blossom. They know where they are. They don't expect to smell Mediterranean air. Don't look under their pillows. Their houses are brick, and if a rose blooms, basta. I think of Etruria when grandmother mentions Rome, and when she says God, I remember the one of the wild fig tree, the one whose hands are like mine, she in whose house there is sun enough for figs. I told Almitra what the poem meant to me, and she handed me the copy she had read from. That's the kind of person she was. This reading was at Girlfriend's Bookstore, a now-defunct feminist bookstore that for a relatively short period of time inhabited a storefront on a rundown block of South Street in Philadelphia. It was decades ago, before Fig was published in 1993, and her first collection of poetry titled Between the Sea and Home from Eighth Mountain Press. Almitra and I were friendly rather than friends. Since we traveled in many of the same circles, I often ran into her and her partner, the artist Rocky Toner, at poetry readings, art shows, and events in the lesbian community. Once she was with her adult daughter, who with her large, deep-set brown eyes and gentle smile resembled her mother. Almitra had 3 children from her early marriage, another daughter, and a son as well. As time goes by, memories are increasingly fleeting. I do remember that it was always a pleasure seeing Almitra. She had depth, perception, and perhaps above all, compassion. She once changed my entire perspective about my life with a single short sentence, "But Janet, those are all good things." Almitra was a dedicated Spanish teacher at Friends Select High School in Center City, Philadelphia. I remember that I envied her students. As I look back on my early acquaintance with Almitra, it is almost as if I am remembering myself as a different person. Perhaps we are all less innocent than we used to be. As a young lesbian feminist, I was imbued with the power of one who is intent on changing the world. I was optimistic and never lost hope. I thought people would always be there. In retrospect, I see I was naive. Almitra's death, at age 62, caused by a reoccurrence of breast cancer, is another one of life's cruel and sudden betrayals. Now she is everything she ever was and more. She is another statistic in a raging epidemic. When Almitra's second book of poetry, Impulse to Fly, was published in 1998 by Perugia Press, I introduced her when she read at Giovanni's Room. I said that her work reflected the profoundness of ordinary life and that she also spoke in a poetically ancient voice. When a writer dies, the work survives. Still, I cannot think about Almitra's work without remembering her as a person. Almitra was many things to many people. For me, she was a bridge to earlier writers who have also shaped my world. Once a student of Muriel Rukeyser, Almitra described this legendary woman in a poem to her. Three flights you climb to this room where windows don't shut out October wind. You stand defying the doctor who said, stay home. In this room, women who come together to write. And again you have come to the gates. This time you say to a new power of women, to the woman as writer, you have survived wars to say this. With commentary on lesbian literature, this is Janet Mason for This Way Out.
Can race right through your life at a reckless rate of speed. You can count your worth in dollars and all you have achieved. And you can try to take it with you, but when it's quitting time, the only thing that matters is if you leave a little light behind.
This Way Out is supported by tax-deductible charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. It's you, our listeners, who keep this program on the air, and you can get some queer history, music, and culture on specially produced CDs as a bonus. For all the details or for audio cassette subscription information, please do log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. Thanks to Alternabid and the Stonewall Society, you can bid on some terrific items in an online auction to benefit This Way Out. Look for the This Way Out auction area at alternabid.com.
He was first an object of desire, but became a close friend. Gay writer, director, performer Donald Curry has immortalized him among his recollections of coming-of-age gay during the tie-dyed tempest of 1960 San Francisco in this edited-for-radio excerpt from Curry's Movie Made of Sound, Sex and Mayhem, Part 2.
His name was Mickey, but I called him Blondie, and he was my dark angel. Actually, almost albino, with a poof of cascading tresses blindingly blonder than Monroe's, a rough-hewn horse-like mug, and a fashion sense which was a breathtaking collage of Coco Chanel, Janis Joplin, and Ma Kettle. I came upon him one day at another commune, where the diva in residence, herself terribly blonde, weighing over 250 pounds, lay ensconced in cherubic glory in a canopy within a Sarah Bernhardt bedroom. The whole seraglio hung with a phantasmagoria of shawls, beaded curtains, birdcages with hopping, tweeting little fellas, statues of naked ladies in louche poses, and flattering indirect lighting. And there, in the deep recesses, the incense-filtered light lounged Big Miss Thing. Dressed like an opera curtain ready to rise on a Franco Zeffirelli production of La Traviata performed by Mae West, and lounging beside her, dressed also in a get-up of his own cracked devising, an improbable but mouth-watering lacy satiny ensemble, was the formidable bitch Mickey. Reduced, next to the mountainous Earth Mother at his side, to an auxiliary servile role of brushing her silky locks as she cooed and laughingly exhaled a thick nacreous cloud of hashish smoke into the dimly lit room. Honest to me, oh God, it was right out of Aubrey Beardsley, and I was having it. Mickey was a valley boy with a spicy all trailer trash cachet. He'd left his dreary home at 16 to live on the streets, and once he was gone, he never looked back, except in horror and some significant soupçon of shame, which he never quite shook, even until his ignominious dying day, a needle dangling from his scarred and withered arm, his blonde mane gone skimpy and fright white. But that was a ways away, after he'd lost all his friends but one. And in the beginning, and it was almost biblical, he was such a force of nature gone awry, the bitch hit the streets and tore through them like a jackhammer in a frilly frock, and no one who got in his tornado way ever forgot it. He was practically illiterate, and had the smartest, sassiest tongue you'd ever hope to be lashed by. To his everlasting dismay, his kisser was a hee-haw riot. Not plug ugly, but he was no great beauty, and he knew it and hated it, since he could pinpoint a needle of hot stuff in any haystack. But he had animal sex appeal and could score a trick with breathtaking dexterity and brazen chutzpah. Driving down Polk Street in his old 53 Chevy, he'd spy a lounging Lorelei on the corner and have him in the back seat in no time flat with a line like, "Hey, baby, want some beer and AM music?" He was innately funny like all great clowns, and he could practically kill you with his Jane Mansfield in the bubble bath routine, popping up out of the suds with dumb blonde aplomb, exhaling some breathy throwaway line about his soapy pizza, or if his boyfriend happened to be in the room, exclaiming sotto voce, "Get a load of that crank," then grabbing his big bulbous nose and sinking down into the foamy tub, looking more like Marie Dresler than Mansfield. His timing was nearly flawless, and his delivery unmatched. When he walked in a room in some black and white ensemble, looking like a corkscrew Art Deco cartoon, a big picture hat tilting insanely and his braided tresses curled up on either side of that drop-dead puss in two Heidi chignons, his bone-white face highlighted by a blood-red Cupie bow mouth, everyone stopped in their tracks and just gawked. He was a walking work of art, an evanescent genius, now gone to dust. He could sit down at a piano with his hair piled high, tarted out with cascades of shimmying feather boas, looking like a buffoon homage to poor Janice. And when his fat, stubby fingers hit those keys, he became possessed by something bluesy and Beethovian, and he grabbed you by the throat, throttling you with his raging, torn soul, tearing up the keyboard in a primal fit, and following his final, raw, rapturous cadenza with a belt of wild turkey and a mad cackle, leaving us all silent and stunned. No applause necessary. He was the goods, plain and simple. But in a social situation where he felt that he was mixed in with his betters and that his from hunger past was showing like a dusty valley town five and dime window display, he would suddenly clam up and bow his head in a desperate bid for invisibility and be as adorable and abashed as Marilyn in her lost orphan mode. We bonded, Mickey and me. We huffed a bit at first, but settling soon enough for a gal pal kind of setup. Spending our afternoons chain smoking, dressing up and ironing our hair until we felt ready to make our entrance into one or another low dive in the burgeoning gay hippie jamboree, sashaying into the stud like a low rent Jane in Maryland, and sampling whatever drug du jour was being handed out like door prizes, busting out of the place at closing time, stoned and deliriously bug-eyed, having danced on the bar with all the other revelers, and hitting the street like a pair of stumble-bum palookas, looking seriously now for as much as we could get our hands on. South of Market was gay turf before the Castro could have been conceived of, and it was honeycombed with every imaginable den of iniquity, and we found them all, you betcha. Sometimes we worked them as a duo. But more often, we split up after entering the dark labyrinth and found each other hours later, disheveled and sated, our party dresses all ripped to pieces, gum clinging to the knees of our tights. We would get home as dawn was rousing the rest of the world, staggering into our beds to sleep the day away as youth is wont to do, waking in the afternoon to begin again our saucy, silly, druggy toilette and prepare for our fabulousness de nuit. Needless to say, I was now out with a capital out, and Mickey was my new queer Svengalian guide to the gutter. But most importantly, he was my sister. And we joined at the hip and swore to one another that someday we'd have our own little porch with a pair of rocking chairs just big enough for two. This was not to be, alas. God, in his wisdom, tore us asunder. And that's another story of betrayal and wasteful death. But in memory, we too are a saucy, bobsy pair, always bebopping down the alley in a twirling mist of giggles and gags. Girlfriends forever and a day.
That was an excerpt from Donald Curry's bio audiobook, Sex and Mayhem Part 2, produced with and engineered by Jason Gorski. CDs of Sex and Mayhem Parts 1 and 2 are available online at cdbaby.com/Donald Curry. That's C-U-R-R-I-E. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Rick Watts, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Janet Mason, and Donald Curry contributed program material. Jess Hawk Oakenstar sang Leave a Little Light Behind, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. This Way Out is primarily supported by tax-deductible charitable donations from our listeners, and we thank you. It's you, our listeners, who keep this program on the air, and you can get some queer history, music, and culture on specially produced CDs as a bonus. For all the details, please do log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 2BLU Katoomba, New South Wales, WEFT Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, KUGS Bellingham, Washington, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.